Oh, hey there. I'm Margaret Wappler, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show picking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winter Mitchell-Rohrbaugh.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Happy Thanksgiving, Wappler.
Happy Thanksgiving. And because this is our Thanksgiving episode and we're going to be talking about awkward family dinners, I'm going to refer to you as my sister who always criticizes my stuffing recipe.
I could see that.
So don't try me, okay?
A little dry this year, Margaret.
Always something. And we have pop culture scholar Karen Tongson.
Hi, Margaret. Hi, Rocketeers. As you can tell, my voice is even lower this week, and it's kind of gravelly. It's been a rough one.
You also went to Palm Springs, so let's just throw that into the mix.
Let's just admit that it's an extended hangover.
Yeah, a little bit.
All I did was like float in the saltwater
pool. That's all it takes, baby.
Yeah, that's all it takes. And a few margaritas or 20.
It's true.
And for this, Karen, you are going to be my gay aunt who sold me a bunk Subaru Forester.
Can't I just be the drunkle? That's probably like most apt for me. But also, I do have a bunk Forester. Like you
every
know.
Lesbian has one at least in their history.
Somewhere, yeah. I married into
Lesbaru.
One. Yeah, Lesbaru.
That's right. Coming up in this week's show, that most staid holiday tradition, stories of awkward family gatherings, lots of clinking silverware, you know the vibe. Plus, we'll be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen, what is up?
So I have been just scraping the bottom of the barrel, like watching as many new network shows as I can. I think like I was in a little bit of health stress over a period of time, and there's nothing more soothing to me than just like going for the middle, just like watching things that are just completely like lowest common denominator stuff. Mm-hmm. And I happened upon something that actually turned out to quite enjoy. And this is a new sitcom on NBC from this fall called Single Parents. And it actually stars Taron Killam, a.k.a. Kobe Smulders' husband, formerly of SNL. And he plays Will Cooper, who's this over-invested 30-something single dad who's just so devastated from his breakup, from being left by his wife, that he immediately signals to the other single parents of this like elementary school milieu that they need to kind of help him out because he's just, you know, too busy like making special snacks and volunteering for everything and trying to get all the other parents to be like volunteering for all the school stuff. And it's got a pretty all-star cast in it, like Leighton Meester, who knew that she would be on a sitcom like this, and Brad Garrett, who just came off of the I'm Dying Up Here, a real dramatic role on that Showtime series, and now he's back to doing sitcom stuff. He plays a widowed doctor with twins. So his like kind of young trophy wife passed away unexpectedly. Now he's left with these twins and he's like, oh shit, I wasn't supposed to have to do this.
Oh my goodness.
And Kimree Lewis owns a wine bar. She has a flamboyant son. And there's another of, in a long line of recent TV Asian bros, this guy Jake Choi plays someone named Miggy Park, who's this younger dude who's been left with a baby, essentially. And he has no clue what to do. No clue what to do with it. And this group, this motley ensemble of single parents just kind of gets by. They have all their kids are kind of actually interesting. Most of the shows like this make the kids kind of treckly and cute and like annoying.
Yeah.
But these kids are really interesting. And the dynamic between the adults is also one that like kind of shirks perfect parenthood, but has a lot of heart and some pretty fun, humorous and adult situations. So watch it if you can.
So it sounds like there's a lot of dads, like single dads. It doesn't focus on single moms.
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing. It like kind of breaks away from the kind the single mom trope, and it's a pretty even mix. So it's like three single dads and two single moms. You've got several different races represented and age groups. So, you know, you kind of and you also one of the things about it is that each of them has their own struggle to getting to the point of an equilibrium with their single parentdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of what we learn about as each story unfolds. So, you know, it's got a lot of wit to it. And I've watched at least half of the season that's available so far. And, you know, it kept me going.
Nice. Okay. Miss Winter, what's going on in your world?
Y'all.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen The Promised Land, and it is millions of pixels. I bought over the weekend. I really had to think about it because in the last 3 months, I've bought 3 full action-packed video games that I have only like scratched the surface on, but I've been so busy that I can't like really get into. And I'd promised myself after Spider-Man, I wasn't buying another video game, but then Red Dead Redemption 2 came out and all bets were off. I found a really great code that gave me $15 off.
Okay.
And I got the Ultimate Edition. Red Dead Redemption is basically, there was an original Red Dead Redemption, and it's about a cowboy in the Wild West. I don't want to say the Wild West. In the Red Dead Redemption, he was like in the Wild West. This came out like 10 years ago, maybe. And then they added packs to it so you can fight zombies sometimes. But it's been a long time. And a game, everybody's been waiting for this game since they announced that they were going to make a sequel like 2 years ago. This video game is like Oregon Trail on steroids.
Whoa.
It's
whoa.
So good. It's realistic. The graphics are insane. The detail is ridiculous.
Is there a lot of blood involved?
Yeah.
Killing?
There's
maiming?
A lot. We're not there yet because okay. The tutorial alone is about 2 to 3 hours.
Whoa. What? That's a lot of investment.
Is this what kids stick with now?
No.
Like they will take a 2 or 3 hour tutorial?
Because I'd had Aiden get onto it and Aiden was like bored after one mission and it wasn't even that long of a mission. He's like, I don't know. I just don't like this game. And I said, because you need things flying at your face, making silly noises, neon colors, and doing stupid dances, which I'm not going to take that from you. But Red Dead Redemption, I'm looking at through the rest of the holiday season, 80 to 100 hours of gameplay, easy.
Oh, shit.
I like all the characters. My character is, this is what I like about the game beyond everything I just talked about. Super diverse. Because in the Old West, in the first game, it was like the black people were slaves. And they'd be like, hey, no. And in this one, they have a gang, like a rogue gang that's going around trying to basically make it west by hook or by crook. And that means a little bit of stealing, a little bit of robbing, a little bit of, you know, might have to shoot you because you're not giving me what I need. And also survival. So the gang, it's like this ragtag group of like bandits. And there's a black one, there's 2 black guys, there's a mixed race one there. And they all talk about their story, how they got into the gang. But it's like they're just like a gang and they stick with each other independent of race. Nothing yet has come up that's been like, I think it's a very woke gang for the late 1800s. But, you know, like it's a posse. It's a woke posse. And it's the wokest posse I ever seen.
I would play a video game called Woke Posse.
Honestly, yeah. That's what I'm going to start calling it. Yeah. I'm going to start saying I'm playing Woke Posse tonight.
It sounds so much better. Like, no one will question your time then.
Exactly.
They'll just be like, fine, spend 80 or 100 hours with the Woke Posse.
I just love it. I love video games that require that has a storyline, that has missions, that seems like you're carrying a character through a life.
Well, and it creates a narrative, right? It's world building and it gets you involved and invested and sucked in, and that's ultimately what gets adults. Like, we don't, like, the little kids can play the things that just sort of like entertain them for 10-20 minutes at a time. Like, they're not going to go full hog on a world, but necessarily.
But it's interesting because this is the type of, like, I was saying to myself the other day, if Aiden doesn't like this game, who is this game for?
Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's for 20-year-old stoners.
Yes, it's for 20 plus, and I appreciate that it's built for gamers who grew up in a world where they used to be interested in things moving fast and flashing and jumping. You know, I play Super Mario Brothers for like 70, 80 hours a week.
Yes, me too.
But now I want something that has a little bit of like staying power with me. And Red Dead Redemption is another one of those games like Choose Your Own Adventure. You can go this direction and it becomes something else, you know. And the world itself, too. We're in North Hampshire right now.
Mm.
And it's changing into different seasons. And they've just the detail.
Oh, my God. Nice. And somebody like lovingly designed that for months and months and was paid like way more money than any of us make.
But I appreciate
fuck that person.
Them. love them, though.
Just real quick, I want to say that I am disturbed by the fact that I think I could still map out the first level of Super Mario Brothers in my mind.
Yes.
Like, I know it better than, like, my mother's hand.
While you were
talking,
I went through the whole thing already. I've already pulled the flag down the pole.
Yep. It's
and
not...
I warp, warp, warp. That's really good.
We all need help. Okay, now this is my all about, and it's kind of different. maybe I need to play more video games. Like
I'm telling you,
I do. But you know what? I stop because I really get addicted to them. Like
I do
get
too.
Into it, and then I'm
irritated.
Pissed.
I sent 3 calls to voicemail today.
Oh shit!
I don't care.
Whoops. But not whoops.
You spend $90 on something, it better be worth your while.
So Amanda Hess, you guys, is one of my favorite cultural critics at the New York Times. And she wrote this.
This is very different.
Very different, right? Yeah. But it does tie into our theme in a way this week. She wrote this critic's notebook on The End of Endings, it's called. And I just want to read you first the opening paragraph. The age of the sequel is over. Now it's the age of the sequel to the sequel. Also, the prequel, the reboot, the reunion, the revival, the remake, the spinoff, and the standalone franchise-adjacent film. Canceled television shows are reinstated. Killed off characters are resuscitated. Movies do not begin and end so much as they loiter on screen. And social media is built for infinite scrolling. Nothing ends anymore, and it's driving me insane. I love this opening paragraph because it just pulls you in, and the ending of the opening paragraph of her saying it's driving me insane, I was just like, yes, amen, I feel you. The reason it reminds me a bit of what we're talking about this week is because in, you know, re-immersing myself in the various family dramas and comedies that deal with awkward family dinners, I realize there's barely any movies like this anymore because it's not built around a franchise. It's not built around like a Marvel property or whatever. It's often just like an indie script that like Sarah Jessica Parker agrees to be in and like, you know, Holly Hunter and whoever else. And it did make me feel like seeing these movies like really nostalgic for those kinds of just like almost theater play like movies where it's just you throw 8 or 10 characters into a room and you just let them fight it out with no explosions, no blah-de-blah, et cetera. But at any rate, Amanda Hess's whole thesis in this piece is just basically how, like, nothing has an ending anymore. I mean, exactly what she said in the first paragraph. Like, nothing, we can't really count on anything to ever, like, die or conclude. You know, even a show like Breaking Bad, now it's going to be a movie. Deadwood was a show and it got canceled. Now that's going to be a movie. Game of Thrones has killed off various characters only to bring them back to life. Roseanne comes back and then Roseanne gets canceled and then it goes into the, you know, family without Roseanne.
The sausage mill as the Connor and then through the sausage mill into the Connors.
Yeah. And it's like it depresses me in some level because it's like we can't like the studio system and TV networks and even Netflix and these other places that are new and have money and energy and things like that are just so risk averse, you know, that they always will go with what they think is the sure bet. And there's not as much, they're not willing to sort of take chances and say, let's just put this little like screwball comedy together.
Well, I was just going to say, I think the true litmus test for something being a prestige show is whether or not it actually ends. Because the shows that have ended that I've been very sad about ending are Mad Men.
Yes.
The Americans.
6 Feet Under.
And Halt and Catch Fire, right?
And Six Feet Under,
which was, you know, a slightly earlier era of The Sopranos or what have you. But these shows have still ended. And there seems to be no future for them or no spinoffs or no sideways. Like, kind of, I think that people fantasize about that to certain, especially when The Americans ended, you're just like, you know, oh shit, like, you know, what if we find out, like, what happens to Paige and if she's, like, a spy or blah, blah, blah. And you know, no, those worlds are over, right? And
yeah.
And I think that there is a tremendous loss from it, but there's also tremendous satisfaction in the end of that narrative arc. So all you have left to do is just to watch the whole thing over again.
Yes.
You know, whereas a lot of these other things cheat death in various ways. It's like video games, get back to what Winter was just talking about, where you can always find another life.
You know, in some ways I get the temptation to not have anything ever end, right? Because we've all had that experience moments of ending a book or a show or whatever. I mean, Six Feet Under, that last episode just devastated me.
But I don't need anything beyond that.
Of course, because they all friggin' die. I mean, we see how they die, but like...
The ultimate finality.
Yeah, but like, you know, it's kind of... I think part of why there is no ending anymore is somewhat to do with fan fiction, right? Like this, you know, the last 10 or 15 years has seen the internet embrace this... mode of storytelling, which is basically to take a fan favorite and then just have people generate stories that are inspired by it. And that's a beautiful thing and a beautiful new tradition, but I feel like in a way, and it's very democratizing, you know, it's like whatever's popular just gets reinvented again and again, but like, I still just want to have things end so that it's special.
I
how do you feel?
This is a lot. I also feel the same way that she feels and you feel. I feel like there's really no way for anyone in the studio system to have an original thought. It just sounds like this is what they're sort of left to deal and fend with.
Yeah.
They've tried things that were alternative or would not have necessarily been something that was like, you know, straight to order Thursday night, you know, opening that night. And they've had some hits, but they've had so many misses. And the things that were counterculture, you know, Black-ish, Modern Family, those things, that these shows are a little bit older now.
That's true.
So it's like, how do you capture an America, especially for a TV network, how do you capture an America that is completely split?
Mm-hmm.
And then how do you capture people that are less inclined to pay attention to whatever it is you're doing? I can't tell you what, I don't watch shows on network television. I just don't.
Yeah.
There's nothing there for me and they've lost me completely. Whereas 30 years ago, I should have been sitting right in front of the television, you know, trying to figure out how to adjust my night and my diet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing for me on cable television. I don't relate to any of it at all. So if they bring something back that I like, I will give it a chance. Like, we gave Murphy Brown a chance. I haven't seen it since. There's not many things that they could bring back at this point from when I was a kid. Everything's been ruined. So, yeah. I mean, Perfect Strangers, maybe. I mean, like, that's...
Punky Brewster, maybe.
I just think there's so many things that have been ruined that I really, really, really was into that they can't... They just can't reignite and, like, bring back. Roseanne was the last straw for me because I was one of the only people who in this group that actually was going to give it a chance until she just
went too far.
Yeah. And that's when I was like, you've tarnished an entire legacy of really quality programming.
Yes.
And now I can't.
In like a few tweets.
In a few tweets.
Yeah.
And so I just don't know where I'm supposed to go anymore with the content.
Y'all ruined it.
All right. You're listening to Pop Rocket. When we come back, we're going to dig into that dry turkey and shit's going to get awkward.
Hi, I'm Dave.
Hi, I'm Graham.
And we're two house DJs who have been trapped inside our drum machine.
We love it here, and we'd love if you stopped by and visited us every week on Stop Podcasting Yourself
here on MaximumFun.org.
We're just a couple of doofuses from Canada.
And listen to our show or perish. Stop Podcasting Yourself
on MaximumFun.org.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell-Rorba.
And Karen Tongson.
So with Thanksgiving and Christmas coming up, there's no escaping the ubiquitous holiday programming coming down the pike. So today we're going to focus on that most enduring and irresistible holiday staple, the awkward family gathering, where your uncle says something maybe quasi-racist and somebody who voted for Trump has the nerve to tell us why, and somebody's ex-boyfriend shows up uninvited. Guys, what do you think the quintessential holiday movie or show dealing with the interpersonal dynamics of family members is?
I mean, I think the one that is the locus classicus of the contemporary era is Home for the Holidays. I think that, you know, from the beginning to the end, that movie scripts the whole encounter of being home for the holidays so beautifully. From the moment she loses her coat and has to run around in her, like, you know,
her mom's like marshmallow
puppy,
yeah,
jacket, to, you know, again, dealing with the kind of is it a drunkle or like, you know, just, you know, the playing the tunes, the awkward flirtations, the brother all going crazy, not like not enough booze and yet too much booze. I think that that film encapsulates the whole experience of, you know, what it feels like to be infantilized when you go home and having to relive just all of that, not just awkwardness, but so many different layers of trauma that manage to seep their way out in at events where everybody's just supposed to have something special. So I think that that is, to me, the quintessential awkward holiday dinner scene. I mean, there are other awkward dinner scenes certainly out there, but yeah.
Well, I think that the thing about that movie that is so potent, and we should just say a little bit about it, is it came out in 1995. It's starring Holly Hunter. Anne Bancroft plays her mother. Robert Downey Jr. is there as her brother. There's lots of people actually in this movie. Claire Danes plays her daughter, who's off to go have sex with her boyfriend for the first time. And I think what's so potent
Charles
about...
Charles Durning is in it?
That's right. Charles Durning is the papa. And what's so potent about this movie and other awkward family dinner movies is that it gets at that thing that happens to all of us as adults, where we can be in our regular lives with our families not in the mix, where we're just like, we have our jobs, we have our friends, we feel confident, we feel good, things are going well. Then we get home and we just turn into these like raving lunatics. Like everything that our families sort of bring out in us, the ways that we feel insecure or vulnerable or like whatever their sort of toxicity is that you just can't push aside, like all comes rushing back. Like no matter who you are, you can be like a very successful curator at a fancy museum. No one gives a shit when you're home for the holidays.
Yeah,
I would agree with you about that movie.
I turn into like, I totally regress into like a bitchy adolescent every time I have to actually go home for like a holiday dinner. And yeah, no matter how old I get, it's just at some point I just like am acting like I was when I was 13.
Yeah. You just can't help but go back to those old roles. What
I
about you and her?
It has to do with the, I don't know about you guys, but I grew up in big extended families and they just all started like factioning off for, you know, life reasons, interpersonal reasons. And eventually it just sort of got to be to the point, I guess in my late 20s, mostly in my early 30s until now, where I just really don't like the holidays because it always, the pressure to be the one to cook or help, the pressure to have more than just your immediate family there. It always ends up being a good thing because the four of us reinforce how much of a unit we are. But now that, you know, I'm married and then my sister has a boyfriend that I just think is a douche, like now.
Sorry, Megan.
Yeah.
Whatever. I just feel like I don't know. I still don't yet know, and especially with the extended family, which, you know, my husband's ex-wife and their son, which, you know, she has him most holidays. It's just all like not, it's a continuance of it not being solidified, like what this new season looks like for me. So I feel like nothing will be real until I have kids.
Yeah.
I feel like nothing is like, none of this is means anything. It's other people's dreams.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like, it won't matter to me until my family is complete.
Well, it's interesting because since I've had a child, and granted, he's so young right now that he's not really like paying attention to what mom or dad are doing as far as like setting up any kind of traditions at all. But I've already started to think ahead of like, oh, well, we need to have a really special like Christmas for him and Thanksgiving for him. And I'm finally like, oh, this is how it starts.
Yeah.
This is how the craziness begins of like, you know, your mom insisting on making the same like crappy carrot and orange jello salad every year. And like, you know, people just get hung up on making a beautiful occasion. They have the best intentions, but it's often that pressure, right? That's like the worst part of it.
I literally walked into a Tuesday morning, which is a store with a bunch of crap in it. and was looking for holiday stuff. And I was like, and he was like, it's not even Thanksgiving yet. And I was like, it doesn't matter. I got a tree skirt. I got a wreath. And then I was like, and this is the interesting part. I was looking for black Santas and could not find a black Santa.
Not surprised. Yeah. But they've got to be out there.
But then I started getting mad. I went on Amazon, but then I started thinking to myself, oh my God, like now this is going to be my Everest. I need a black Santa.
Yes, it
or
will
there
be.
Will be no Santa in the house. Like, I don't want to see one white Santa anywhere in my house. And it just didn't realize, like, I have to define my own Christmas because I there are things that I want that remind me of what my grandmother did. Those big, chunky lights. I don't like little baby lights.
Oh, I like the baby lights.
I love big, chunky lights that might set everything on fire. I like the risk. I just think that there are things that I want that I'm going up against now with, you know, Alan, who has things that he just feels like makes sense. And I'm like, we have to figure this out.
Well, okay. Is there a movie, though, that you feel like captures your family experience or just in general is the quintessential holiday family movie?
As it stands now, I mean, we talk about this movie all the time.
That's okay. We have favorites. They know.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like, again, having just done the 200th episode, there are certain, I guess, touchstones in the Pop Rocket Arcana.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, Pop Rocket Arcana is just like Carly Rae Jepsen. And I think I know where you're going.
And a family stone.
Exactly.
I mean, I don't remember us talking about that.
Guy brings it up several times, even when it's not
a holiday.
Yeah.
I think it's more like the family stone because my parents are ultra liberal, hippie, disco ducks. Who, like, don't, like, talk about the revolution any chance they can get, miss it dearly. And his parents are not. They're the exact opposite. And we both become children in the face of our parents. And him being a mama's boy and me being a daddy's girl, there's just, like, it's kind of like combat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, The Family Stone, that is a really good example of a movie that captures how a conversation at the dinner table can just completely enrage and unravel the family, right? So we actually have a clip from The Family Stone where we hear Sarah Jessica Parker asking some questions of the family, much to the chagrin of Diane Keaton, who's playing the mother, and
Craig T. Nelson.
Craig T. Nelson, who's playing the dad.
Well, one of the contributing factors to being gay may very well be the environment.
Well, I mean, look at my drapes, right? Aren't they horrible? There's absolutely no way it was this environment.
Meredith, most of us here believe that sexual orientation is a result of a genetic predisposition, much like handedness.
Hand? Well, that and Mom. They tried to make us all gay.
Hey, what are you talking about? I didn't try, Everett. No, true. I did hope. I did desperately hope that you would all be gay. All my boys. And then you'd never leave me.
A few minutes into this scene, when you see basically the dad gets really angry at Sarah Jessica Parker for intimating, or not even intimating, and she pretty much directly says, like, why would anybody want to have a gay child? That's such a burden. And he slams his fist on the table.
And says, enough!
Enough! Yeah. And she goes storming out of the room. By the way, she's the fiance of, who is it, Dermot Mulroney?
It's Luke Wilson.
It's Dermot Mulroney.
Oh, it's Dermot Mulroney.
I mean, they're almost the same person.
They are almost the same person. It's true.
You know? They were, like, in the same movies all the time playing brothers.
Okay.
But it's really heartwarming at the end of that scene because you see Diane Keaton tell her son, the gay one who's also deaf, in sign language that she loves him, and every time I see it, it like gets me teary.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I thought it was really sweet.
I know. I just
the
it
movie gets,
me. Gets
more trickly as the holidays roll by. I just don't.
I think it's Diane Keaton though. It's like she just does a really good job in that moment of just summoning all the things we love about Diane Keaton.
And also
the warmth
maneuvers,
and the charm,
though,
and the, like, casualness.
Like, I mean, those maneuvers to try to, like, tamp down any awkwardness or, like, kind of mask over really difficult issues through, like, laughing through the phrases.
Right, and, like, trying to make it a joke, you know, oh, I'm not a good decorator, so I couldn't have had gay children, blah, blah, blah.
I deeply recognize that in my mother, who will constantly laugh awkwardly to frame various comments in different ways, like, again, to kind of mitigate any situation. I have a very impassioned political father who's a socialist, who's a total Bernie bro, who is like, and he's intense, very intense. We had actually a very difficult dinner recently that I totally live tweeted at some point because that's the only way I could handle it. And it was a very deep political conversation. And, you know, each partner I've ever had who has had a dinner with my family, I've always had to, like, I try to, like, warn them, like, if you get past this point, it's gonna be, you're going to have a raving, like, socialist, Marxist, white, baby boomer, white man, like, you know, raging with passion at you.
Yeah.
And like, you will have a bunch of,
who
you
wants
know,
that?
And who wants
you
that?
Have a red wine on hand.
Exactly. And then even then, you're just like, oh, wow. Like, let's try to, like, let's soft you out of this. But that's the other thing that I find always really kind of stressful, and that the Family Stone kind of, you know, really kind of sets up for everyone to experience, is that fear that you have coming into a mixed dinner situation with other people's family or with friends who you don't know or partners you don't know, and not knowing whether anybody's going to bring up anything political or how it's going to go, because this, the slightest turn of a conversation, can lead to this real precarious unraveling of things.
I just don't know why anybody would bring up politics at dinner. That's the part that seems to that it's like throwing a cannon into a cave. Where, how do we sit down to dinner about to enjoy, like, hopefully a really tasty and enticing meal, and you're like, okay, so Trump, okay,
but
so
I think it
Obama.
All,
I think it
all depends on
that.
The family,
or I think,
you
know, it could just be something
my family,
organic.
We talk about politics all the time, and we all get into it, and we get into, like, talking about the ideas that different politicians have, and, like, granted, and, like, and my family is split. I mean, there's conservatives, and there's my brother keeps voting Libertarian. Yeah. I don't really know why.
That's my brother-in-law. We're gonna go to his house.
Yes.
For Thanksgiving.
Oh,
so
the Libertarians.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me because, I mean, I love them and respect them. And you know what? Nobody did vote for Trump. That is the big, like, line in the sand.
Well,
that would make it really hard for me.
I don't know that.
You don't have that certainty.
No, I don't have certainty. There's no, and that's what's interesting is, like, I don't have to worry about conversations about politics coming up because there's no one on his side would ever admit.
Yeah.
Or be in my face if they were to admit that they voted for him.
Yeah. I think, though, that it happens actually through conversations that you might think are innocuous, that are about pop culture or about something else, because your taste or your, you know, like, we talk about this all the time
they're
on
signifiers.
The show.
They're signifiers. They're quiet signifiers. Yes. They're ways that we say, like, I'm progressive without actually saying it, or I'm conservative.
Well, at the last Thanksgiving, that also, again, hosted at my brother-in-law's mother-in-law. So, like, we were all, a bunch of us were there in Santa Fe, and we knew that there were, you know, some Trump voters who, like, were there, but it was just a mere mention of, it was like an actress or something that became a sort of dodgy moment in the conversation. And I can't even remember who it was at this point, but I remember, like, when we were talking about, it was some comedy that had just come out, and I could tell that people were on high alert, like, and wondering where the conversation was going to tip. But luckily, you know, someone soft chewed their way out of that by being like, does anybody want more rolls or whatever, you know?
Yeah, you got to have, like, a lot of those soft doughy crescent rolls on hand, because those can heal any war.
But pop culture actually ends up being the Trojan horse of awkwardness and kind of political conflict or other kinds of conflict, right?
Absolutely. Well, I do think, too, that, like, in addition to politics, there's just the sort of cultural differences that we can embody that also can make for a very chafing family dinner. And I'm thinking in particular of like one of my all-time favorite movies, Flirting with Disaster. Another movie from the 90s with Ben Stiller. And basically he is on a journey to find his biological parents, which his adoptive parents really don't want him to do. And they're like uptight and kind of shiny yuppies who just don't understand why he wants to go on this like journey of self-discovery. They're just like, what is this bullshit? And he goes on this venture and eventually finds his parents who are played, his bio parents who are played by Alan Alda and Lily Tomlin, and they are cut from a very different cloth than him and his adoptive parents. Basically, they are like these old hippies that make crazy art and like live off in Mexico and spent all this jail time. That's the reason they had to. I'm spoiling this movie, but you know what? It came out in the 90s, so just catch up. They are living in Mexico. They spent all this jail time because they were making LSD, and that's why they had to give him up because, you know, it's inconvenient to have a baby when you're in jail. And it's just so wonderful to see all the kinds of personalities chafing against each other. Namely, he has Tia Leone with him, who is...
Tia is like she's also like a good person to have around in these awkward movie scenes.
Absolutely, because
right?
she's so funny in a really like uptight, snub-nosed way. And in this movie, she plays a very uptight adoption agency worker who basically is trying to help him find the right people. And somehow there's an alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agent in the mix who is played by Richard Jenkins, and he gets dosed at the Thanksgiving dinner. And it is a beautiful thing. And if you haven't seen it, please
doesn't
see
everybody
Flirting with Disaster.
Get dosed at that dinner, basically?
You made LSD? Is that that's what you're saying?
We made LSD.
Yes, we made acid.
And we gave it out to people who needed it.
You know that there are hundreds of pharmaceutical executives in this country that are selling drugs, FDA-approved drugs.
On the open market.
On the over-the-counter with incredible...
Terrible side effects.
And these people are not in jail.
Not in prison, anywhere.
They're in country clubs. They're playing golf. They're having drinks.
Running the country. They're running the country now.
You know, LSD shouldn't be a felony.
This sounds
running
like,
the country.
This sounds like one of my family dinners.
I know. And what's funny about that conversation is that it's actually become so much more relelevant now than it was back then. Where I'm like, I'm on the side of Lily Tomlin and Alan Alda.
100%.
And they, I mean, Alan Alda and Lily Tomlin, it's a dream team. They just like beautifully feed off of each other.
It's funny because like these forms of awkward like holiday dinner were only introduced to my life once I had like a white stepfather and like had, you know, white spouse and like white family members because, you know, Filipino.
Welcome to our crazy dysfunctionality.
Because Filipino like holiday dinners, first of all, it's not formal. You don't really sit down. There's just a table covered with 7,000 dishes and people milling around and doing talent shows, basically,
this
you know, for
so
each other.
Much more chill
and like,
awesome.
You know, drinking and standing by the barbecue and like, you know, singing karaoke or doing like performing for the grandmas. Aww. And, you know, yeah. And so it's sort of like, so that was always a thing that kind of like trying to figure out how to like tip these dinners to the Filipino side of things most of the time. But with that said, one of the things that is a running through line between my different cultural sort of backgrounds is that, you know, who says grace or who, you know, especially at a Thanksgiving dinner, like there's always that awkward moment, especially when you're just kind of gathered together with people for the first time, even if it's getting the whole family all together, my in-laws with my parents or whatever. It's like, well, who's going to say grace? And that's the start of the awkwardness right there. Who's going to take a long time? Who's going to not take, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that we've got a couple clips from some films where that is the kind of source of the kicking. That's the kickoff to the profound awkwardness of the situation. One from Talladega Nights. And of course, the famous Meet the Parents prayer scene.
Dear tiny infant Jesus.
Hey, you know, sweetie, Jesus did grow up. You don't always have to call him baby. It's a bit odd and off-putting to pray to a baby.
Well, look, I like the Christmas Jesus best, and I'm saying grace. When you say grace, you can say it to grown-up Jesus or teenage Jesus or bearded Jesus or whoever you want.
You know what I want? I want you to do this grace good so that God will let us win tomorrow.
Dear tiny Jesus, Golden fleece diapers with your tiny little fat balled up fist pawing.
He was a man. He had a beard.
Look, I like the baby version the best. Do you hear me?
Oh, I love it so much.
Then we have Meet the Parents.
Greg, would you like to say grace?
Greg's Jewish, Dad. You know that.
You're telling me Jews don't pray, honey? Unless you have some objection.
No, I'd love to. Pam, come on. It's not like I'm a rabbi or something. I said grace at many a dinner table. It's okay. Oh, dear God. Thank you. You are such a good God.
This is basically me when I'm charged with leading Grace. I'm like, I never know what to say. Can I just babble my way through it? I should say, I think Ben Stiller, you guys, is basically the patron saint of awkward family dinners. Like, he's been in so many movies where it's an awkward family dinner at the center of it.
Yeah.
And Meet the Parents, Flirting with Disaster. I also just saw that he is producing a movie called Friendsgiving. That's going to be out next year. That's with like Malin Ackerman, Jane Seymour, and Kat Dennings. And it's all about like a dysfunctional friend Thanksgiving.
Oh, see.
Which is another world that I never got into because there's also a part of me that just feels really sad that we all can't either muster up the strength to go to be with our families or that we don't have anybody else to. The last sad Thanksgiving I had was with an ex-boyfriend and who was a boyfriend at the time. And I just remember sitting there thinking, this is exactly, if I hate holidays already, this is exactly what I don't want to do. I wish I were like on the set of Friends because they did Thanksgiving right. Out of any show on television to me in the last 30, 40 years, the way the cast of Friends the Friends on Friends did Thanksgiving, you know, marking all these different hallmarks that would occur throughout the years, those 10 years. I laugh at every single episode. They recently did like a marathon on TBS of just the Thanksgiving episodes.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
Yeah.
I totally now want to just like find a way to do that.
You
myself.
Could just do it on Netflix.
Exactly.
You just
like curate it yourself.
Curate it yourself and just watch it. Just put it on, play it in the background. I just like the way they did it.
I mean, just to go back to the Friendsgiving concept for a minute, I am a big advocate of it. Actually, like several years ago, I made the decision to not travel back home for Thanksgiving. Like, not because I hate my family or anything. I actually have a pretty good time with them. But it's like almost the traveling alone that just sets up so much pressure and bullshit.
Yes, for sure.
Like, I didn't, you know, like getting on a plane for 4 or 5 hours to go back to Chicago or Atlanta or New York or wherever it's happening, I just didn't want to deal.
Yeah.
And so I've been having Friendsgivings for probably about 10 or 15 years now. And it's been a beautiful tradition. And granted, we've actually had some fights amongst our friends at Thanksgiving, but it's always been fine.
Yeah.
It's different when you're fighting with your friends.
I love it. I mean, one of the things that I did was just to take over Thanksgiving for a period of time. And so the way it would be was just like, we'd have a huge Friendsgiving.
Like orphan Thanksgiving?
Yeah,
would you have one of those? Yeah.
We'd have one of those. One year we had like up to 30 people at it. We had
beautiful.
Because my parents are nearby, so they come and a couple other family members, but it's mostly like Friendsgiving and then people had other parents. Anyway, that was really great. But one thing, though, I want to add to the Thanksgiving dinner movie canon, or like not movie per se, but something that did it right is, of course, the Thanksgiving episode of Master of None with Lena Waithe, that Lena Waithe wrote and won the Emmy for, and that had Angela Bassett in it, and that went through the years of dealing with this character.
Yeah,
and
I think it was a really beautiful structure.
Yeah,
to
that's
tell
the
that
one
story.
That you play in the back. That's one like, you know, actually like play the TV episodes that or the TV series that handle Thanksgiving well, and I think that will make for a good watching and joy on Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's a really good idea to just have that in the background. Mm-hmm. Guys, I think we have to end this on a note from August, Osage County, a scene between Julia Roberts and her mother, played by Meryl Streep.
Eat.
No.
Eat it.
Mom.
Eat it.
No.
Eat it, you fucker. Eat that catfish.
Go to hell.
That doesn't cut any fucking ice with me. Eat the fucking fish.
Mom, I have something to talk to you about.
No, you don't.
Barbara?
No, you don't. Shut up. Shut the fuck up. Please!
What's to talk about?
Mom, forget it. Eat the fucking fish.
I'm not hungry.
Eat the fish, bitch!
Eat the fish, bitch!
So I kind of hope your Thanksgiving isn't that hardcore. I hope that it is loving and you are spending it with your chosen family and that you cherish the day.
That's our official, I think that should be our official Pop Rocket Thanksgiving greeting. Eat the fish, bitch.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after a break.
Hey, Kira. So Max FunCon tickets go on sale this Friday, November 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific, and I'm trying to write a promo.
Okay, so what do they need to know to look forward to? Inspiring classes.
Live podcast tapings.
A stand-up showcase.
The s'mores party.
Making new friends.
Don't forget about the dance party!
Oh, and it all takes place on a beautiful mountaintop.
Okay, got it. Anything else?
Well, if we missed anything, they can find all the details at maxfuncon.com.
And we'll see you in June! June!
I think that went really well.
That was really good, too. I really,
yeah, that sounded good.
Great job!
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. We have finished the turkey and we are on to the pumpkin pie. I'm your host, Margaret Wappler. With me in the studio are
Karen Tongson.
Oh, sorry. Okay. About Brad Pitt. Winter Mitchell Warbaugh.
Winter is so bored at this dinner that she's been on her phone.
That's me.
The tryptophan hit Winter. Maybe the jams will wake her up.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we'll be asking our panel, as we always do, what's your current jam? Karen?
You know, I'm no big fan of Shawn Mendes. I have to say, I find his voice generally irritating. But there's something about this song, Lost in Japan. I know that this might give Winter PTSD.
I'm triggered.
So, like, anyway, for some reason, I'm really drawn to this kind of weird, like, jazz fusion-y groove going on in this pop tune. And I just want to give it up. So here is Lost in Japan by Shawn Mendes. It's a fun little cute bop. It's kind of like when Justin Timberlake used to be fun and not like all, you know, like
such good
singing
times
about
when
trolls.
He was fun.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So that this brings me back to that like kind of joyous pop sound. And, you know, this is probably my favorite song of his. And I love the idea of like, I'm just going to hop on a plane and fly to my booty call, you know, like that. Like, I love the sentiment of that. Happy holidays, y'all. That's what I'm feeling for you.
Winter, please do tell me your jam.
I don't have a jam today, per se, as this is just my jam, because, like, as I mentioned last week, I'm listening to Michelle Obama Becoming, and I'm taking it in, like, little bits and pieces, because I feel like every single day that I hear something else, the jewels and pearls of wisdom that she has to offer us, it just really feeds my soul, and I just... Here's my jam. It's three quotes from her book, which might seem treacly, but if you put it in the context of what this woman experienced, the 18 months campaigning alongside Barack, the 8 years of being the First Lady of the United States, you know, and polarizing a country, but galvanizing those of us with, you know, a brain in our head. I really feel, again, now that she's sold nearly a million books in the first week of its release, and to me, a very subdued way, right? In a subdued manner. She's not on The View. She's not, you know, going on Steve Harvey. She's not on Wendy Williams. She's, you know, really committed to social strategy that I really think is impressive. She's doing this speaking tour, going and speaking. I know the tickets are expensive, but look, would you expect to
pay? It's an event.
It's an event. And
people
take
pictures there.
Yes.
Like a nice setup at each of these things
where
you can take pictures in front of like these backdrops and other stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's look, you go to Coachella and do less for more. You can pay $800 and go listen to the First Lady of the United States try to help you live your best life. I mean, come on. You walk out of there and you're not drained of vitamin B because you've been doing Molly all weekend and can barely hear because you've got tinnitus. The quotes are, "We needed now to be resolute, to keep our feet pointed in the direction of progress." And this is when she's talking about sort of the struggles she was going through one of the more difficult situations during Barack's presidency. "This is my personal favorite. For me, becoming isn't about arriving somewhere or achieving a certain aim. I see it instead as a forward motion, a means of evolving, a way to reach continuously towards a better self. The journey doesn't end." That was particularly impactful. And the third one is, "There's power in allowing yourself to be known and heard, in owning your unique story, in using your authentic voice. And there's grace in being willing to know and hear others." There's just a number of these types of notable quotables from this book. Look, she's not the first person to ever write an autobiography or her own biography. She's not the first person to be the First Lady of the United States. But there's something to be said about someone who was most recently at the helm of this country with a very difficult position, given she was the first Black First Lady of the United States, and all the things that were stacked up against her, she really turned everything on its head. And even the blows that she took, the resiliency of this woman, the magnitude of her resiliency is so empowering and so encouraging. And just, you don't understand how much I appreciate her words and her wisdom at a time like this, in a moment like this, in an era and a climate like this.
And now I will ask myself, what is my jam? And my jam this week is from a sweet little five-piece band from Brooklyn. They're called Barry because the front person is named Barry Lindsay. And they make some really dreamy synth pop. And they haven't dropped an album yet. They've just been like slowly wallpapering the world with these singles that are really beautiful and lush. Here's Michigan. So part of the reason I wanted to play this song is because without fail, it makes Silas dance. And you guys know that I have a weakness for jams that make my baby dance. And like, particularly like pretty much like twerk. Like he really does move his little booty. So yeah, that's Michigan.
That sounds like a real California driving song to me though. Even though it's about Michigan, yeah. It's like just that, you know, kind of driving down the 101 vibe.
Totally. And like, I mentioned wallpaper not as like, obviously not a diss, but like because it's the kind of song that you can sort of put in the background, but then when you pay attention to it and really look at it, it's actually like rich with detail.
Super gratifying.
Yes. You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Margaret Wappler, with Winter Mitchell-Rohrbaugh and Karen Tongson. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it after all these years. Thanks to everyone for the 5-star reviews in iTunes. If you haven't already, get on it. Please review us. It's Thanksgiving. Give us a gift. Be grateful for us if you could.
Please.
Just for a moment.
Thank you.
I have no idea what it takes to get this done.
Just like Alanis Morissette, thank us. This week, we would like to thank Trees Are Green 13, who says, "It makes me miss LA, especially when they talk about local events. It's a great counterpoint to the East Coast-based Slate Culture Gabfest. They have turned me on to so many new things, and I appreciate their perspective." Ooh. Thank you, Trees Are Green. I'm glad you like our West Coast style, our Best Coast style. Rocketeers, we would love to hear from you guys. Specifically, we'd love to hear your show ideas, because whenever you guys suggest a show, we often end up doing it because you basically have stellar ideas and we're kind of lazy. So call 530-237-4108, aka Guy Branum's mama, up there near Sacramento, and tell us what you think we should talk about. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group, or find us on the Instagrams at Pop Rocket Podcast and join in the discussion. We're a production of MaximumFun.org. The show is edited by the sweet Shayna Deloria, and our senior producer is the lovely Laura Swisher. Happy Thanksgiving.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.